Then Elisha said, "Hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, tomorrow be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, in the gate of Samaria." Then the Lord, and a Lord, on whose hand the king leaned, answered the man of God and said, "Behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, might this thing be?" And he said, "Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof." Now the background to this story this morning is this. Syria, that pagan nation that lay right to the north of Palestine, came down to invade the land of Israel. And the king who led the army told his men, "Now my camp is going to be in a certain place between two hills in a certain valley, and we will camp there secretly. We'll move in secretly, and we'll start to make inroads into Israel." But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Elisha the prophet and said to him, "Now the king of Syria has camped his camp in this place. Don't go near there, or you'll be besieged." And so Elisha told the king, who told his generals, who told his armies, who told the men of Israel, and they thwarted the design of the enemy, and the enemy were not able to make any inroads against them that day. The king of Syria therefore changed and moved his camp into another area. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Elisha and revealed unto him where the camp was. And time after time this happened. Every time the king of Israel would move and secretly put a camp in a certain place, the Spirit of the Lord would reveal it unto Elisha the prophet, and the children of Israel were saved from the designs of the king of Syria. And so the king of Syria called his men together and said, "Which one of us is a traitor? There is a traitor in this camp, because every time I decide to do something and tell a few chosen men, the enemy always knows what I'm going to do before I do it. Now, somebody's a traitor here." And one of them said, "Well, O king, the situation is there's a man of God down here. And whatever you speak in secret in your bedchamber, the Lord tells him openly. That's the problem. None of us are traitors." And he said, "Who is this man?" He said, "Well, his name is Elisha. He's a prophet in Israel." And he said, "Well, I want some spies to go into that land, and I want them to find out where he is. And we may go in and take him." And so they brought back a report saying, "We have spied out the land. We found that he's living in Dothan." And so the king said, "All right, we'll take an army, and of chariots and horsemen, and we're going to move in to Dothan and take Elisha. And when we get him, then we can go about the rest of our business to get Israel." And so they moved in with an army. And one day, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, standing out on the balcony, he looked out and he saw that the mountains all around were full of iron chariots that were so filled by Israel, of the Syrians. And he looked about him on all sides, and terror gripped his heart as he saw them down the hills. Here will come streaming chariots of iron with soldiers in them. And he yelled out to Elisha and said, "Elisha, look! The hills are full of chariots." And there was a terror and a pending feeling of doom within him. And Elisha walked out to the balcony and he looked. And he said, "Oh, Yahweh, open the eyes of my servant that he might see." His problem, Lord, is he's looking with natural eyes. The Lord opened his eyes, and he saw about the hill, the mountain that he was on, the mountain was full of chariots of fire. And I suppose that maybe Elisha could have said within himself, "This is going to be interesting." And as the Syrians came down, Elisha said, "Lord, smite them with blindness." And the Lord smote the armies of Syria with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Elisha left his residence and walked down to the road. And as these men were now brought down to a slow walk, and they couldn't see, and they were in the chariots, and the horses were moving along Elisha went up to the leader, and he said, "This is not the place, neither is this the road of the city for the man that you seek. Come with me, and I will take you to the place." And so he got up into the chariot, lead chariot. Everybody was blind but him, and they started off. And he led, and all the rest of the horses were just following horses, you know, the people in them. And I suppose the neighbors, you know, peeking out the window and said, "What is Elisha doing sitting up there within the head chariot of the king of Syria?" And here with all these men all behind him following up the along the roads, going all through that land, about 15 miles, he took them to the city of Samaria. When he got into the city of Samaria, then he said, "Now, Lord," and here comes all these armies right in, Syrian army, and everybody was blind. And he said, "Now, Lord, open their eyes that they may see." And the Lord opened their eyes. And when they were all in this long column, their eyes were open, they found that on both sides of them, there were men right there with spears right at them, Israelites. And there they were, caught. No, Elisha didn't tell them any lie. That was not the place that the Lord had in mind. They could not get to Elisha's, find Elisha by going up to his house, because you would know he left his house. He was down on the road. "You come with me and I'll show you the man." And he did. He came with him. He showed him the man himself. But he showed him himself in Syria, not in Dothan. And that was the road, and that was the place where God would reveal the man. And that's exactly what he told him. And so the king of Israel said, "Shall we smite him? Shall we smite him?" And Elisha said, "No. If you had captured slaves by the sword, and you had captives, you wouldn't kill your captives, would you?" "No," he said, "make a good feast for them. Feed them good and send them home." And he said, "Mercy," and he showed him mercy, and he fed him, and he sent him home. Well, it so affected them in their hearts that they left him alone. They quit fighting against him. Well, people who can do this and show such mercy, they left him alone. But then Ben-Hadad took the throne of Israel, and he came down against, Syria, and came down against Israel, and the Lord brought Israel to fight against them on the mountains. And Israel was greatly outnumbered, but it was made a great slaughter of the Syrians. And so the Syrians, after picking the wound, said, "Well, their gods are gods of the mountains. That's why we were defeated. We were much bigger than them, stronger than them, numerically superior, and better warriors, and yet they defeated us. And so there has to be a reason they defeated us." The men are always thinking, see, and so they must be gods. They must have gods of the mountains. So let's go fight them in the plains, and then the god of the mountains won't help them. That's the trouble with having too many gods. Got one god takes care of everything, like Yahweh, you're in better shape. And so they went to fight him on the plains. And the Israelites said they were like children, and few before, and they were, the Syrians camped everywhere and throughout the whole country. They were so numerous. And the Israelites slaughtered 100,000 of them in one day. And they fled. And then they caught Ben-Hadad, the king. And Ahab was king of Israel at this time then. They caught Ben-Hadad. And Ben-Hadad came and said, "Well, I understand you Israelites have a lot of mercy." And he asked to be let loose. And so he said, "Now, I'll tell you what. If you let me loose, you can come and make streets in Damascus in my city, just like we made, our fathers made in your city. And we'll bless you in our city, and you can have certain things just like we had, or we did, and we'll let go all the cities that we took from you, my fathers took from you. I'll let loose, and you can have them if you let me go." And Ahab let him go. And an old prophet disguised himself, and as the king was coming by, he finally said to the king, now it amounted to this, Now, because you have let go Benadab, the king of Syria, which God had brought, delivered into your hands for you to slay, so you shall give your life for his life, and you men for his men. And when Ahab lost his life in the battle, next battle, and many of the men did. And then we see that Benadab now comes down against Samaria. He's coming against the capital city of Israel, the northern kingdom, Samaria. And this is where we are in this today. And so we read in 2 Kings 6:25, as he comes down to besiege Samaria, and they blockaded it. They couldn't get in because the walls were too strong, and so they made a blockade, and they begin to say, "We'll starve them out. They can't come out, and we just starve them out." And they began to have a great famine. They ran out, began, were running out of food. And there was a great famine in Samaria. It's a walled city, remember. And behold, they besieged it until an ass's head was sold for 40 pieces of silver, and the fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. This means that they were completely out of food. And people were so willing, gold didn't mean anything anymore. Jewelry, nothing meant anything. They were given anything. They had no food. Unless you were wealthy, you had nothing. And even if you were wealthy, you had to give great sums. In order for a person to be willing to depart, to give you a scrap of some food, which he would rather have, he wanted a tremendous amount from you of other things. They weren't sure they were ever going to be able to use all that money anyway if they died. And so an ass's head, it cost them 8 months' wages to buy an ass's head. And that which is normally thrown away. You couldn't even buy a steak anymore. That was completely out of the picture. 8 months' wages. How did you give 8 months' total wages for the only food you could ever get? You had no food, period. We're giving an old ass's head. 8 months' wages. That's total wages. And you have to have something else to have besides that to live on and to wear and so forth. Normally you could buy a slave for 3 months' wages. And he would work for you. A slave can do an awful lot of work for you in 10 years. And for 3 months' wages, you could buy a slave. Now it costs you 8 months' wages for an ass's head, which there isn't much meat on an ass's head, mainly bone, and it's soon gone. What it is there is poor. And 1/4 a cab of dove's dung. That means 1/4 of a pint, about 1/4 of a pint, just a handful of dung from a dove. We have a few doves left. 2 weeks' wages. 2 weeks' total wages. To be able to eat refuse from a dove was how bad it was. Verse 26. And as the king of Syria, Israel, was passing by upon the wall, there cried a woman unto him, saying, "Oh, help, O my lord, O king." And he said, "If the Lord do not help thee, when shall I help thee?" I can't help you. The Lord doesn't help you, there's no help. Out of the barn flow, out of the wine press. Now, what would we do? Go down the wine press and give you some wine, or would you care for something out of the barn? You know they're both empty. How can I help you? And the king said unto her, "What aileth thee? What's the matter with you? What's your problem?" And she answered, This woman said to me, "Give thy son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow." So we'll cook your son, eat it today. We're dying anyway, and they're going to die. And then we'll share my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son, and we did eat him. Isn't that terrible, isn't it? And I said unto her on the next day, "Give thy son that we may eat him," and she hath hid her son. She hasn't been failed. And it came to pass when the king heard the words of the woman that he rent his clothes, he grabbed his robe and he tore them. And as he passed by upon the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth within on his flesh. They tore his king's robe and they saw he had sackcloth on, which is a garment you wear when you're lamenting and mourning. And he said, "God do so and more also to me if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand upon him this day." This is Elisha's fault. You know, they always blame the men of God when judgment comes or something happens. And Elisha sat in his house, and the elders sat with him. And the king sent a man from before him, but ere the messenger came to him, Elisha said to the elders, "See ye how this son of a murderer hath set to take away mine head? Look, when the messenger cometh, shut the door and hold him fast at the door. It is not the sound of the master's, it's not the sound of the master's feet behind him. And while he yet talked with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him, and he said, behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Then Elisha said, hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel. That means 2.5 gallons of fine flour for 3 days' wages. That's a big improvement one day. Who's going to get all that food? And 2 measures of barley for a shekel. That means 5 gallons of barley for 3 days' wages. It should be sold in this gate of Samaria, right here in Samaria, tomorrow. Then a lord on whose hand the king leaned, that was his right-hand man, answered the man of God and said, behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven and just dump down food, is this thing possible? How can this happen, even if he dropped food out of heaven? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof. And there were 4 leprous men at the entering in of the gate, and they said one to another, why sit we here until we die? We're lepers. We're sitting here. We're dying. What good is it to sit here and slowly starve to death? If we say we will enter into the city, let's leave now and go in and go out, then the famine is in the city. If they sat by the city and said, now if we leave and go into Samaria, the famine's all over. That won't help us any. And we shall die there. If we sit here, we die also. Now therefore come and let us fall into the host of the Syrians. Let's go right to the camp of the Syrians. We're going to die anyway. If they save us alive, we'll live. And if they kill us, well, we'll but die. We're going to die anyway. So we might just as well go out and take a chance and go right into the hands of the enemy. They put us to the death with a sword, well, at least it gets it over with. And if they save us, at least we're saved. And they rose up in the twilight, and they go to the camp of the Syrians. And when they were come to the uttermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. For the Lord hath made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said one to another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the king of the Hittites and the king of the Egyptians to come upon us. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and they fled for the life. God heard, caused them to hear a noise of horses without horse noise. You know, I heard a story, of a Pentecostal minister who went up hunting in the mountains. And I forget what part of the country this was, but a great snowstorm came in. He got separated from he said, I'll go over this ridge, and some other men went over another ridge, and he got separated from the rest of the people in the party. And he didn't know the area too well. And the snow began to fall heavier and heavier, and he couldn't even see hardly. And he couldn't find the road. He couldn't find his way back. And pretty soon he knew he was lost. And night began to set in. It was cold, and it was going to get bitter cold. And he knew he was in trouble. And he began to pray unto the Lord. The rest of the men finally late in the evening said, well, we can't wait any longer. They knew that area. They said, this is a real blizzard. And in that kind of country, they said, when a blizzard like this comes in, you said, we've got to get down there. We'll never make it. We'll all die. So we can't find him. We don't know what happened to the minister, but he'll die out there. There's no way for him to live. But we can't stay any longer. So they all piled in their big truck and took off. And they never heard from him. It took 2 weeks. That snow blizzard was on for about 2 weeks. And finally, the minister came into town, and they were so surprised. And he told the story. He said, I think it was about the second or third day. He was out, and he was freezing cold and without food, and he was going, trudging along, and he was praying. And you better believe he was praying in tongues, too. He was praying. Not only for that which he knew, but that which he didn't know. He was praying. And he said, All of a sudden, he said, the snow quit falling, and almost at least. And I looked up on the hillside, and there was a man riding a horse right across the hillside. And I yelled to him, but he kept right on going. And he said, I ran frantically up, he said, to try to get to him. And he said, I trudged up through the deep snow, and I got up to where he was, and there weren't any tracks. And he was gone. And I looked, he said, and there was clean fallen snow. And I had good vision. I looked over. I looked this way, and he wasn't there. And I looked back the way he came, and he wasn't there. And from the ground, there wasn't a track in sight. And then he said, I looked over at the bottom of the hill, and there was a cabin. And I went into the cabin, it was open. And I built a fire, and I helped myself to some pancakes and other things, and some powdered milk and so forth. And said, I had breakfast, and he said, I stayed there for 2 weeks, ate food. And 2 weeks later, after the blizzard was over, a man came in and who owned the cabin. And the minister paid him for the food, staying there, and I was fine with the man. The man took him back into town. But he said, the point was, God caused me to see a horseman that wasn't there so I could find the cabin. It was right over the hill, and I didn't know it was there. God caused something to me to get up there so I could see it. But there's no way God makes a way. He's a God of the impossible. So they heard of horses and chariots by the thousands, but there wasn't any chariots or horses. And when the lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into one tent, and they ate and they drank, and they carried thence silver and gold and raiment, and they went and they hid it. They came again, entered into another tent, and they carried thence also, and they went and they hid it. Then they said one to another, we do not well. This day is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come, let us, that we may go and tell the king's household. We're nice and full, and we've hid all this gold and silver, and there's more than we could ever eat or use, Hill. And this isn't right. Now that they were full, they said, you know, we better go back and tell them. We're going to have to get into trouble if we don't. And so they went back, and they called the porter of the city, and they told him, saying, we came to a camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no man there, neither the voice of man, but horses tied and asses tied in the tents as they were. And so they told the king, and the king said, now look, I'm not so... Don't you see what these Assyrians are doing? They have left the camps and they're waiting. They're baiting us. And they have purposely done this. And as soon as we come in, take the food, they'll come down out of the woods and they'll slaughter us. But the situation was so precarious, and if it were true, it would be fantastic. They said, well, we better take five horses. All they had left. The king had five horses, but they hadn't allowed anybody to kill. And you know, the king was eating. You know, you always believe the king was eating. And he said, oh, we had five horses. Now, we'll take these horses, and a few men will go out, and we'll find out. We'll search this matter out. And so they went, and they passed the camp and rode off in all directions to check. And the further they went, they found clothes, they found garments, they found swords, they found all along the way. They fled in such panic. They were throwing things as they were going. They left they fled. They didn't even bother to get the equipment, even their asses, and so they just left them all and fled, and they found stuff all the way down the river and across, and they came back and said, it's true, there's not a person in sight all miles around. And so they came in and took that all which they had and brought it back. And so, verse 16, and the people went out and spoiled the tents of Syrians, so a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. And the king appointed the Lord in whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. And the people trod on him in the gate, and he died, as the man of God had said, who spake when the king came down to him. And it came to pass, as the man of God had said to the king, saying, two measures of barley for a shekel, a measure of fine flour for a shekel, shall be tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. And the Lord answered the man of God and said, now, behold, the Lord shall make windows in the heaven. Might such a thing be? And he said, behold, I shall see it with thine eyes, but shall not eat thereof. And so it fell out unto him, for the people trod upon him in the gate, and he died. They were in such a rush to get the food, they just ran right over top of him, and he died. And did not eat, just like the Lord said. Let's look at some of the lessons that we have learned and can learn from this chapter. We've learned, first of all, that the enemy is constantly besieging the saints of God, but the saints will triumph in the end. We learn that God sees the afflictions of his people, and God will rout the enemy. We learn that today's impossibilities become tomorrow's realities. When I was a boy, only the Pentecostal people spoke in tongues, and all the other denominations, right down to a man, said they were heretics, fanatics, of the devil, and over-emotional, and would have nothing to do with it. At that time, according to the word of the Lord, the scriptures, in the last days I poured my spirit upon all flesh, and according to the scriptures concerning the latter rain and the valley of dry bones and so forth, there were some who dared preach that which they saw no hope of. But most people could not have a vision for such a thing. It was impossible to believe that God would pour out his spirit upon the Episcopalians and others who were so adamantly against it. But we are living in a day and an age where about 30 million or so of these denominational people have received the Holy Spirit and have spoken in tongues. They're leaders with doctor's degrees. They're theologians. They're ministers. Pastors by the thousands upon thousands and upon thousands. Pastors from many, many, many denominations in the United States and around the world have embraced this truth and said we were wrong. And are rejoicing in how God has blessed them. They have grown tremendously. And so sometimes we stumble when God speaks to us and says, such and such a thing will be, and I will bring you perfection. My people shall know my name. They shall put the Spirit of the Lord upon them, and they shall go forth as a mighty army. They shall be born in the day. They shall do exploits. These signs shall follow them that believe, and they shall raise the dead. And there shall be a unity of the faith. Some people, again, say, if the Lord would open windows of heaven, might such a thing be? How could it be possible? It's just too great to believe. But I want to tell you, it'll happen just like he said. According to the word of the Lord, it shall happen no matter how impossible. If God says that he has brought deliverance and he will deliver you and perfect you, it will happen. I don't care how many years you've struggled against it and fought against it and say, it's impossible. God says it is possible and it shall be. And I am the author and the finisher of your faith. And I will perform that good work in you that I have started. It will be performed. It shall be done. And I believe it shall be done. Does your enemy have you blockaded? Are you starving to death spiritually because your enemy has besieged you and besieging you? I'm going to tell you something. God has routed the enemy. Go and see. Many are dying because they won't go and see. You're dying anyway. You might as well go and see. There are people from many denominations without the Spirit of the Lord, and they're dying. They're dying. Their denomination is dying. They've been watching it die for years, and they won't go and see. God has brought deliverance. He has delivered us. Go and see. Take that deliverance. Many people are seeing, and they're rejoicing and feasting in it. While the others are still back in Samaria, moaning and groaning, dying in spiritual famine. Others are out here eating and feasting and praising the Lord. The promises of God oftentimes to the natural mind are irrational. But God doesn't work according to man's rational judgment. God doesn't work according to circumstances. God works according to his own sovereign will. God will turn famines into feasts. Those that are dry, he'll make the desert, he said, a pool of water and springs of water. He'll take the Dead Sea and cause fish to live in it, he says. He's going to run water down through that desert in such volume. You know how the desert soaks up rivers. In such volume, it's going to rush in that Dead Sea and spill it out over the south end. It's going to run to the Mediterranean Sea and clean out that salt sea until there'll be fish swimming in it and be life. Palm trees will spring up in the desert and orchards. The millennium right ahead of us. The Lord has said it, and it shall be done. God will do that to you spiritually. You're dry and in famine. God will give you life and spiritual food if you will dare to trust him for it. Now we find here that the women representing the churches were so much in a famine, they were devouring each other's offspring. But you know, that doesn't happen in revival. But when there's no revival, the churches ought to hurt each other's throats. So they're devouring each other's offspring. They're in a famine. But bring the spirit of revival. They don't treat each other's offspring and children like that. You wouldn't think of doing that. Think of doing that. Also, we find here that the king had sackcloth on. But they still had problems. He was in mourning, but they were still in famine. But the problem was the sackcloth was on the loins, not on the hearts. And the proof of that is that he did not pull down the golden calves from Dan and from Bethel. Now, if he had been, his trouble was that he was mourning the calamity, but not the cause. We have a lot of leaders today the same way. In the church, there are a number of spiritual leaders that are mourning the condition of the church. And they will say, well, you just have to get used to it, folks. We're losing the church. People are not going to church anymore like they used to. We're going to get fewer and fewer. Pews are getting empty. We just have to realize it's the way it's going. People are becoming less religious. And there are people who are concerned, and many in the evangelical circles, they're concerned about lack of revival in their churches. They're concerned that there isn't these things happening. But a lot of them are mourning the cause. They're mourning the membership of the church. They're mourning the finances of the church. They're mourning the program. They're mourning the blessing, lack of blessing. But they're not mourning the cause, and they won't put the sackcloth on their heart, fall on their faces and say, oh God, we have not gone your way. We filled your pulpits with programs and playthings. We filled the churches with supper rooms instead of upper rooms. We become the sugar of the earth instead of the salt of the earth. We have become servants of men instead of servants of God. We have not followed thy way. We have followed tradition. We have not been willing to die to self. We have been elevating self. And we are not willing to pay the price. And so they're still mourning and they're still in famine. But famines are caused by idols. Malachi 3 Chapters 8 through 11. An idol is anything between you and God. Whether it be money, whether it be your wife or husband, whether it be your son Isaac, whether it be anything, that is an idol. Malachi 3, verses 8 through 11. Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. This is God speaking. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me. Even this whole nation has robbed me. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and will pour out you a blessing. I will open you the windows of heaven. We're talking about the windows of heaven. That there shall not be room enough to receive it. If you will do your part, if you will have enough faith in God to support the work of God by faith, you say, well, I can't afford to do that. Well, you can't afford not to. You can't afford not to. Have you ever figured out what it's costing you spiritually? Have you ever figured out what it's costing the church spiritually? When you rob God, you pay for it. When God says, now every seventh year, you let the land lay fallow. And every Sabbath of years. And every 50 years, you let it lay fallow for 49th year and the 50th year. But the people didn't want to do that. They were money hungry. They wanted to make that land get all the value out of it they could. They wouldn't let it rest. They were ruining the soil. And so God finally said, all right, count up all those days. They add to 70 years. I'm going to take you out of the land, put you in Babylon for 70 years. That land's going to rest for 70 years. You think that you're not going to pay? You're going to pay. All one lump sum, 70 years. That's what the word says. That's why it was 7 years in Babylon. Because they had let that land rest for 70 years to make up for the period of time that they didn't let it rest, according to the words. You can't shortchange the Lord. You can't get around it. If you won't give yourself a living sacrifice, then you will not get the benefit. If you won't give your money, your time, your talents, your heart, your life, everything there is, if we rob God, then we are robbed of God. We are cursed of God. There is no rain fall upon us. But he said, if you will by faith give yourself and everything you have to me and walk with me, I will open windows of heaven. I'll pour out so much upon you, you won't even be able to to accept it all. You'll be like the man of God who finally, in the Spirit of the Lord so much, he finally prays, Lord, Lord, I can't take it. Hold back some of your spirit. I can't take it. This physical frame doesn't know what to do with it anymore. You give me so much, I don't know what to, I just get going to explode. Most of us aren't there yet. Some of us would like to try a little bit anyway. In our government, we have people in our government, they're moaning and groaning the conditions, and in the schools, anarchy on the campuses, burning down the schools, trouble in the cities, but they're reaping what they're sowing. They've taken religion out of the schools and out of the society and out of the way of life, and they've let the communists come in and teach in the universities and in the schools, and they've let all the pro-communists and the atheists and the agnostics, and every time a militant anarchist or a pro-communist or somebody complains, they listen to the voice, and then when the Christians complain, they don't listen at all. And they are weeping with the sowing. I talked to a man here who's a head of 50 schools in this area. And I talked to him for 2.5 hours. And I let him know this very same thing. I told him, I said, you're concerned about the drug problems in your schools? He told me, we've taken out everything religious out of all the schools. No longer can have Youth for Christ and on campus. No more in any room, even by the students. We've taken them out. And they were upset because we were doing a little bit of witnessing around the school. And I said, you are reaping what you are sowing. I said, sure, you're concerned about your drug problems. Sure, you're concerned about all these things. But you're not concerned about the cause of them. I said, you're not educating your people properly. Education means to bring up with care, educare. Body, soul, and spirit. You take care of the mind and the body, but where's the spirit? And so we got a spiritual problem in America. Our problem is a spiritual problem. Can't you see it? It's in your schools. It's all over. Burn the nation down. You've got a spiritual problem. I said, you're not educating properly. And I let him know. And to make a long story short, I do want to say this. I told him, he said, well, we just go by the law. And I said, no, you don't go by the law. You break the law. Because the law says you shall not teach evolution as a fact, the Washington state law, and you teach it as a fact, both by your teachers verbally and in your textbook. So you are a lawbreaker. You break the law. Every day you break the law. That's the way I talked to him, right straight. And I said, and he said, well, they don't teach it as a fact. And I talked about these books were full of all kinds of filth in them. And I said, okay, then I will assume as I bring these books to you that you will see what you can do to get rid of them out of the school system. So I said, you'll be getting a letter from me and you'll be getting some data. And I will be bringing some of these things to you, and I will see how honest you really are about obeying the law and about being fair and religious tolerance. You don't want... Some mothers are making a fuss because their children go to school, and a boy stands across the street from the school, and he preaches the gospel, and some boys lean against the fence, great, but 150 of them, they love it. They just are thrilled with it. But the rest of them, they go off and play. They don't have to come. These mothers are concerned. I said, well, some of us are concerned too. I'm concerned about teaching in my church and in my home that God created man, sending my kids and our kids to your schools, and you teach them he didn't do any such thing. They evolved by themselves. I said, I'm against such things. It affronts our liberty, Christian conscience and liberty. And I said, I'm also concerned my children go and we have to read filthy, dirty books put out by the school. Well, they go through a certain board. And I said, I would like to bring you one of these books. and have you read it and see if you want to read it in front of your secretary and in front of the PTA and see if those people, they'll want their children listening to this kind of filthy things about homosexuality, brothels, filthy terms, twisted, bent minds. And so what I'm going to ask you is, parents and children, school kids and so forth, any data you have, names of books, so forth, of evolutionary books that definitely state that man did evolve and so forth, and other filthy types of literature and so forth, give me names and situations, bring me data, I'm compiling some information. I let him know, I said, you know, I said, we've even considered about, I said, if all these churches would get together who are funded by this, I said, and make an issue of this, you might find you change your whole school curriculum. You might find that your evolutionary teachings and all the other filthy books and they may have to go and your whole system be overturned. Now, he didn't want that, of course. He didn't like it. He didn't want to be contested. I let him know that, not that we were going to do it, but I let him know that if this were done, you know, just kind of let it hang there a bit. And so you bring me information written down and make sure it's accurate. Make sure it's accurate. And please do that, though. And I'll write it right soon, real soon. Please don't forget that, because here's the, I feel like since he rustled the bushes, here's a good opportunity. Here's a good opportunity. I told him, I said, we're starting a Christian school because, I said, we all parents are so concerned we can't stand to have our kids go and have be lied to in school anymore. And I told him the lies they taught. I gave him quotations. I told him how they twist history and lie and distort. And I said, and we still have to pay taxes for the schools. I said, it's getting a serious matter. I let them know that there's voices on the other side. So you move in that area, please. All right, now to go on with this. I don't believe we should just turn the whole world over to the devil. We get our children out there. And I told, And you can tell your children too. I think that when they explicitly begin to teach against the things of God and ridicule the Bible and so forth, just tell your kids to raise their hands and say, I object to teaching contrary to my religion. I believe the Bible is true. I believe that we should obey the parents. I believe in righteousness and godliness. And I am affronted by this. And take objection to it. And if they don't hear it, go to the principal and tell them. And if they say anything to you about doing it, say, my pastor told me to do it. And my pastor said that he'll come up and talk to you if you object to me doing it. And I will. Absolutely. Don't let them get by with it. Your parents, stand up for what's right. Write the letter. Write the letter to the principal and the teacher. One teacher I wrote a letter to, well, she wished I hadn't written a letter to the principal about it. See? Write to the principal and the teacher. Let the principal know what the teachers are doing. I told him, I said, your problem, sir, is that you don't know what's happening underneath you. He denied it. Oh, these things don't happen. I said, yeah, they do happen. And I'm going to bring you reports of it, and I'm going to prove to you that they happen. I said, your problem is you don't know what's happening down underneath you, perhaps. Now, we find here also that judgment begins at the house of God. Judgment begins at the house of God. So, yes, God delivered him, but before he delivered him, he let judgment come upon him. Because they weren't doing right. Because they had idols in their land. And listen, I'm concerned about people coming into this church and who've got idols in their hearts and they won't walk with God. Because you know what happened? Elisha walked with God, but he had to go through the famine along with the rest of them that wouldn't walk with God. You get the picture? People of God have to go through spiritual famine in the church because the freeloaders and the others who come in that won't give anything of their heart and life and time and money, and they won't give anything of the, and they won't walk with God, and they get idols because they are keeping a damp on the service, bringing hindering spirits in against the service. They won't give the life to God. They're destroying the unity and the whole body, and the rest of the people have to suffer the famine right along with them. Now, I'm not trying to get hard against them. I'm just trying to say, make up your mind, like Moses did. All that are on the Lord's side, come on this side. If you're not, get on that side. Quit being mugwumps and standing in the middle. Get on one side or get on the other. Either follow God or don't follow God. If you want God, come here and cry out before the Lord and seek Him. If you want to play games and just have a lovely church, don't come here. We don't play games here. We don't have lovely services here. We get busy with God in our hearts. We're concerned for God to move. If you want God to move with all of your strength, come. If you've got problems, we don't care whether you've got problems. We want a heart of dedication. We'll pray with you and help you through your problems. But if you don't want to walk with God, please don't come. Just stay away. We'll be much happier. Much happier. We don't want anybody who doesn't want God. If you've got problems, we'll bear with you. But don't go come and try to baby your problems and pamper your problems and make excuses for your problems. Come and lay on the altar and cry out unto God and ask for help and deliverance, and God will deliver you. But you've got to make up your mind, too. You can't just cry out for help and then refuse to give yourself over. You've got to make a decision for God. Either do it or don't do it. Hear the word of the Lord. Do it or don't do it. God never did teach the man be pamby along for month after month after month after month while they just not refuse and refuse and refuse and rebellious. Come a day, God said, cut them out. Go up and kill those prophets of Baal. Get rid of them out of the land. I'm almost done. Chapter 7, verse 5. Now these lepers rose up in the twilight. They rose up in the twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. What I want to let you know is, when the light came, as soon as it became light, twilight, at the very first light, they went and saw. At the very first light. God expects us, at nighttime, you can't go. We don't expect people to come in and feast upon the Lord during the night when they haven't got any light. But as soon as you get a little bit of light, just twilight, when the sun just begins to peek over the hill and you begin to see a little bit, go out. Go out. Now, I want to let you know, these were lepers. Leprosy is a symbol and a type in the Bible of sin. They were the first ones to the feast. You know, it's still that way. The hippie out here, and the ones who are taking drugs and living in sin and all of those, they're usually some of the first ones to come to find God. And then the leaders, when they come to find God, they bring others. Leaders always bring others. But oftentimes people have to bring leaders because the leaders are standing out here and they won't move. But some of their parishioners are moving. So they've been so sick and tired of being sick and tired of playing church and being dead and living in a famine. They want the power of God. Either this thing is true or it's not true. Either it's believable or it's not believable. If it's true, let's act on it, live in it, make it change your lives. If it's not true, we better throw it away and become atheists. Why sit and become a so-called church member's lovely book? Of course, we don't believe it's all inspired. A lot of myths and all things wrong, and we're not going to follow the part that is inspired, but it's lovely to come. And they'll just sing the platitudes, hoping that maybe God, it might kind of cover us. Since it won't cover anything. You either walk with God or you don't. You either believe it or you don't. Either God's a liar or it's the truth. Verse 8. And when these lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into the tents, and what did they find? Silver, gold, raiment, and food. Four things. Gold in Scripture, typologically, is a type of deity. They found God, which is the source of all life. They found silver. Silver is a type of redemption. In the tabernacle, all the sockets and all the bases were made of silver. The bases were made of silver in the tabernacle sanctuary. And it came from the two shekels that were atonement money. And it's a type of the atonement. You found redemption through Jesus Christ. You can't get gold without the silver. You cannot get God without the redemption bought by Jesus Christ on Calvary. The third thing then is raiment, then they were, that which represents the righteousness of Christ. They were clothed so they were not naked any longer. Then we have to be clothed, we have to have raiment, and then we have to have food to build us up and make us strong. To build us up and make us strong. And so we find that the order here is silver through the atonement. They have gold, God, and they are clothed with his righteousness, and they are fed with his food. That's what it represents. Typologically. When the lepers found blessing, they did not keep it all to themselves. They went out and told others. That's what we're supposed to do. Don't keep it to yourself. You found eternal life. Go out and tell others. There's enough for all. There's enough for all. And I close with verses 19 and 20. And the Lord answered the man of God and said, Now, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, might such a thing be? And he said, Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shall not eat thereof. And so it fell out unto him, for the people trod upon him in the gate, and he died. Lack of faith means lack of results, and lack of results means death. That's the order. If you refuse to believe in the Lord, you don't get the promise, and you shall die in your sins. Faith in God and obedience to God are the two things that go hand in hand to bring deliverance and move the hand of God and open the windows of heaven. Whatsoever you ask in my name in faith believing, and the prayers of a righteous man availeth much. If you believe and obey, obey and believe. Obey and believe. Some people believe, but they won't obey. You got to believe and obey. And you know what we're going to see? We're going to see the windows of heaven open here. But there's got to be obedience. You got to get the sackcloth on your heart, not just on your loins. You can't have sackcloth. See, you can have your religious sackcloth on, but you still got idols. You've got to get rid of the idols. You can be at the altar in your sackcloth, great big crocodile tears, but there's idols in your heart that have to come out. When the idol is out, the rain will fall. Amen.